Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Season 15 of Boogaloo begins with Arya's farewell to Jack and Hagar. Lots of Jack and Hagar talk. You can probably hear in my voice that I'm getting over something gunky. However, my conversation with Podrick was recorded before I was sick, so you don't have to hear this voice for the next hour. Scheduling going forward, I have decided that in order to continue the marathon of a chapter-by-chapter reread, I'm going to do 8 weeks on, 4 weeks off. So each season will be about 2 months long, and then a longer break between seasons. Make sure you check out all of the fine work the Bald Move boys are doing, baldmove.com. I am absolutely enjoying their coverage of Shogun right now. If you like Game of Thrones, you might give that show a try. And then, of course, tune in to hear the Bald Move boys talk about it and consider joining the club. Without further ado, here is Professor Podrick McCarran. This Arya chapter, I felt like could have been three different chapters. A lot happens.
Especially compared to the previous one or two, which were quite short and, you know, often like just a given night or 2 days in Harrenhal, and then here suddenly a massive amount happens just between from where it starts, just in the aftermath of Wisa's death, to like ending with basically Harrenhal completely overthrown.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I don't know if, like, sometimes I wonder about these pacing issues. I wonder if it's like, okay, well, we've kind of run through the Harrenhal machinations. He spent a lot of time up until this point in this book detailing all the various power dynamics in Harrenhal. And then it kind of feels like all of a sudden it's just the thing totally flips. And, but I guess that's kind of, that is one of the problems with Harrenhal. It's constantly flipping ownership from one person to the next.
And this is late in Arya's, this is like her second last chapter as well, isn't it? He does like to do this where they have like their second last or last chapter, an immense amount happens. And then like even towards the later, the last maybe quarter of a book, you get like an immense amount happening. And then you get like sort of one or two chapters kind of winding down. Mm.
Yeah, that's right. And I feel like we are building to the climax of this particular book. And relating to interesting ways to take a castle, right? You know, we sort of have these two castles taken by treachery, Winterfell and Harrenhal. And then we are going to eventually experience the Siege of King's Landing, which retains its ownership because Stannis is going to just try to, you know, go head on and go over the wall. He's not going to use treachery. But he did use treachery to take Storm's End.
He's not above treachery.
He's not above it for sure. Yeah. All right. So I guess what's the point? The point is that if you want to take a castle in this world, your go-to move should be treachery.
Well,
because if you try to take it head on, you probably won't take it.
But Harrenhal and Winterfell are extremely poorly defended, right? So, like, Arya makes the point in this chapter that from the thousands of men who were in Harrenhal, now there's only about 100. So no gatekeepers are asking anything. And same at Winterfell, like, everyone's gone. And then not only is everyone gone, there's a couple of people still there. And then they go out to deal with to deal with another problem, and that's when everyone's taken is taken from them, whereas in King's Landing, everyone is still within it.
That's right. But, you know, it's interesting because that's the one where you would think that there would be treachery because everyone inside that castle is starving.
Mm.
And so that is what Tyrion is concerned about. And yet, you know, here we have Stannis who's decided to go right over the top of the wall. Okay, let me read my synopsis, which is going to be rather lengthy here. After a brief visit with Hot Pie, Arya sneaks out into the night to spy the return of Vargo Hoat and his brave companions. In his train, he's brought supplies. He 100 Northmen as prisoners and a black bear in a cage. Arya recognizes the hostages and pleads with Gendry to help her set them free. Gendry refuses. Reflecting on her newfound courage, Arya departs for the Godswood to practice her swordplay. Walking to the Heart Tree, her prayers to the god turn to complaint. Jaqen appears and tells her to name her third name and takes an oath to prove his honesty. She whispers the name Jaqen H'ghar and tricks him into helping her with her plan to free the Northmen. Once the Northmen are free, Arya takes back the name and agrees that the debt has been paid. Jaqen then magically changes his face and hair. They part ways, but he gives her an iron coin and teaches her the phrase Valar Morghulis. The next day, Roose Bolton arrives to take Harrenhal and makes her his cup bearer. Podrick, what do you want to talk about first? We could go a million directions.
I mean, I suppose I mainly want to talk about Jaqen H'ghar again, but before I do that, let's just talk about frustration and how frustrating Arya chapters are.
Okay, tell me more.
So, I mean, I think a lot of people I know who are into the series are also big Arya fans, and both of us are fairly self-professed Arya fans.
Yes.
And her story just is quite frustrating. Like, she's very rarely sort of liberated to do her own thing. She's constantly... well, not necessarily captured, but in this book she's captured a lot and sort of can't do very much. So like from the beginning of this book she's with Yaren, things are okay, then they're captured by Emery Lorch and goes to the mountains men and then Harrenhal, and then things just never go well for her. In the next book then she, you know, they're free again briefly, then they end up with the Brotherhood Without Banners, and then eventually with the Hound. And every time you've all these hopes for what's going to happen, you hope that, okay, she's in the Riverlands, she's going to meet Nymeria again, and this doesn't mm-hmm. happen. And yeah. then you think, okay, she's going to meet one of her family, and then even the Hound brings her to Riverrun, or not to Riverrun, to the Twins, and you're like, oh, finally. And then
yeah, she's and, at the gate, right?
And so it never goes the way you want it to. And then in the midst of all this, in this book, she gets a... like all-powerful murder genie who can kill any three people, and she wastes all of her three wishes.
Yeah.
Every one of them is utterly useless. And the last one, where she thinks she's tricking the genie and being massively clever and helping the Northmen take Harrenhal, well, actually didn't matter because Vargo Hoat had already agreed to Roose Bolton to do this.
Yeah,
so she set it up slightly. Yeah. So it's very frustrating that often when she has access to something, it doesn't get used in a way that's... No, it
yeah.
can't. She learns a lot.
Yeah, I was going to say that sometimes it's frustrating because she is somewhat powerless. You know, she's sort of a powerless character. But whenever she sort of gets to the point where she might be, you know, have an avenue toward power, it's almost immediately taken away from her, right? So she might have the power of a Stark because of social class, but then her father's taken away, or he assigns to her the greatest swordsman in all of Braavos to train her, but then Syrio is taken away. Mm. You know, she could be a warg, right? She could have magical powers through Nymeria, but then Nymeria is taken away. And here, well, she has the death genie. What's that?
She is a warg, though.
Well,
right?
She is right. But she can't use that power to get her out of any of these binds because she has to send her wolf away, right?
Mm. Yeah.
So And in this case, yeah, she's got the death genie, but you know, as soon as she, it's almost like as soon as she has the death genie's gone. And so now here she is, and she says, you know, she, for a while she was a wolf, but now she's a mouse again. So yeah, she's always just about to touch either a key homecoming or a key avenue toward solving her own problems by way of magic or something like that. But Martin always keeps her just like an inches away from achieving any of that stuff.
The payoff better be mighty.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on.
It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
So, all right, let's talk about what is Roose Bolton, who doesn't show up until the very end of the chapter, and we'll have to rewind a bit here to cover the rest of this, but what is Roose Bolton's plan here? Because it's clear by the end of it that he's got some kind of arrangement with Vargo Hoat, right?
Yeah, it's so, I think, and even the fact that the Vargo Hoat was planning and was getting Amory Lorch's men drunk that night does kind of imply that they were already planning and doing it fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But then Arya sort of, you know, sped up the whole process. It's unclear what his plan is, but it is clear that the Northmen are not injured. So, you know, Arya wonders at one point why none of them have their feet chopped off, or feet or hands chopped off.
I noticed that too. Yeah.
So, and she thinks that when she's in the Godswoods, not at the time. So that's probably the first time, if you're a first-time reader, when you first come across this, you think, oh God, they've captured some Northmen. You mightn't think too much of it. But then after that scene, she wonders this, why their hands and feet aren't chopped off. Then
it as strange. I mean, and even Gendry says, you know, he might chop off your feet as he does or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's like he's known for doing this. But then Arya reflects, well, how come none of those Northmen had their hands or limbs chopped?
And they keep bringing it up, like with Pia, she says if she doesn't go soon, Virgo will chop off her feet.
Yeah,
I and Gendry both mention it. So this, it's not like, you know, it's just in the background. It's like constantly, this is the threat, and this is the threat Weis used to give her as well, that Virgo will chop off her feet. So that she wonders that. And then when she's on the prison, she sees none of them seem quite so badly as wounded as they were when Virgo Hoed had marched them through the gates of Harrenhal. So they were clearly, you know, it was an act.
Yeah.
So the plan, Glover didn't know the plan, right? So he says, this soup, that was a clever idea. I did not expect that. Was that Lord Hoth's idea? So they clearly had a plan to take over the castle. They just hadn't figured, Glover didn't know how they were going to do it. They're just like, at some point.
Or maybe there was a different avenue, like, okay, at daybreak I'm gonna let you free and here's how it's gonna happen, and it doesn't happen that way.
Yeah.
But he recognizes that it was a clever idea. I don't know. I mean, it's clear because of when Roose Bolton shows up that it was supposed to happen soon, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, why get them drunk? Why does Roose Bolton show up when he does? So with that in mind, Arya's sense of urgency is misplaced.
Yeah.
She thinks it's up to her to free the Northmen. In reality, if she had done nothing at all, the Northmen are going to be freed within hours or something like that.
Yeah, basically. It did give her... It also drew a lot of notice to her because Shagwell is calling it weasel soup, and somehow it's kind of unclear how this gets totally attributed to her, right? Because she was involved with three others bringing the soup in. Uh-huh. But they call it weasel soup, and in the next chapter, I think, is it Annabelle or something? She berates Arya for letting them in, and Gendry and Hot Pie are both very dissatisfied with her for causing this, which, as you say, would have happened anyway. But it's surprising that it's attributed to her by everyone there. And that makes you sort of think like she's drawing a lot of attention to herself, which is quite dangerous.
So I'm glad you mentioned Shagwell. If you are listening to this and you're like, who's Shagwell? In the books, there's a fool at Harrenhal and his name is Shagwell. And he kind of fits the little tropey thing that Martin likes to do, where these fools have some kind of connection and know certain information that other people don't know. And sometimes it's related to something magic, right? So when Patchface talks about the creatures under the sea or whatever, we would connect this with the Deep Ones. And we've got other fools in the story who have a certain kind of information that they are able to relay to the main characters. In this case, Shagwell the Fool happens to know somehow that it was Arya's plan all along to take the soup down to the prisoners and then kill the guards and free the Northmen, right?
Basically, yeah.
And Martin never tells us how he knows this information, but it does fit into this little trope where the fool in the room gets to say whatever he wants to say. And he happens to know the truth, but no one really takes him seriously because he's a fool. But in this case, I guess people do take him seriously because they start to look at Arya funny.
Yeah, so I think Arya suspects that it was Robert Glover who says about the weasel soup. But also when she meets Roose Bolton, Jaqen N'Ghar is about to introduce her and she interrupts saying, "I'm Weasel." So I guess that was, even without Shagwell, it's possible that, you know, the four of them would have been seen as the people.
Yeah,
who
but
were,
Robert Glover, I don't think he doesn't know who came up with the plan. I mean, she's not very active downstairs. She just happens to be downstairs.
It's true, with soup.
And yeah. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm not sure. It's not said, and eventually Shagwell spreads this rumor.
Yeah.
So it becomes known, I suppose.
Yeah, he hacks off two of their heads and has them talking to each other, saying, how did you die? And then it says one from Weasel Soup.
Now, that was, I wanted to note that because Martin does at times like to throw in a little homage to bands he likes.
Ah.
And so I think that this probably is a little wink to the Talking Heads.
I didn't cop that. Very clever.
So he, every now and again, he'll throw something like that in there. If he hadn't done it seven other times, I wouldn't think of anything about, you know, actual literal Talking Heads.
Makes sense.
All right, let's talk Jaqen N'Ghar.
So many questions. You kind of think you're getting familiar with this character, and then all of a sudden, he just throws everything you knew about him out the window.
Okay, say more.
What was he doing? Like, why was he so terrified when Arya named him? When literally after he pays his debt, He says, "Now this man must die." And then Jaqen N'Ghar is no more. Why the thought of him terrifying him so much? I guess because he's got, like, you know, a mission. He doesn't have time for the faceless man to die. But surely for him, Jaqen N'Ghar dying is no scarier than what he says later on in this chapter about Jaqen N'Ghar dying.
So there's two ways to read this. I guess three ways to read it. One is this is all kind of subterfuge. What he really wants is to get Arya to come with him to Braavos. And so he's kind of playing hard to get, but really he does want to befriend her. And so he's getting her to play along. So that would be one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is he knows that she is naming him by the name he has said. And so her intention is very clear. And so he's going to have to honor that, even though maybe it's not his real name, he's going to have to honor that by committing suicide. I think that that's maybe the one that I like best, but the third option would be that at the end, he's kind of joking, you know, in other words, he knows that dying is not the literal way to interpret what he's about to do. He's about to change his face by magic. And he's using the term dying kind of in jest.
Well, Jaqen N'Ghar is dying, right? Like, he no longer is using that face.
Presumably, Jaqen N'Ghar, if that's the name that actually belonged to that face once upon a time, that guy's dead.
Yeah, so then that was another question I have. Is he like, you know, already, is Jaqen N'Ghar that original man? Is he Larathe who's dead and in the Hall of Faces? Or was he someone in the Black Cells who a faceless man goes, "Ooh, I'm going to, this person will fulfill my next job." So, and then took over this, maybe Larathe sellsword who was in the Black Cells.
So after he changes his face, Arya notes, and this is Arya's, you know, limited perspective, but she says this: the stranger walked away in Jaqen N'Ghar's clothes, meaning that the man is different. That guy's no longer Jaqen N'Ghar.
Yeah.
If that's the way that we're supposed to read it. So, and I honestly, like, I've thought about this a few times thinking, well, is he even Larathe? Because maybe that's just the voice of that particular visage he's donned.
I presume whoever Jack Nagar was is, because he's, you know, got the half red, half white hair, and that accent. But the faceless man is not.
But the faceless man is not. So really, if we dig deep enough, we know nothing about this faceless man.
Which is, I guess, what the faceless man would want you to believe, right? They're no one.
Right, right. That's well said. So what do you think? Why do you think he looks distressed when she names the name Jack and Agar as the third name?
I guess it's because he clearly has some mission, and I suppose it means, yeah, I initially would took it to be the literal that faceless man has to kill himself if he is to do this, because the red god is owed one more life and it's got to be his life. And then later when he says a god has his due and now a man must die, and then ends his visage, it's not the same. But it just is quite confusing, because how he goes on about how name anyone and I will kill them, and then in the same discussion he says some men have many names, Weasel, Ari, Arya. So
mm-hmm.
I wasn't really able to establish a sort of coherent reason for like why he was so terrified, and why, if Jack and Agar is just some body he's using, the death of Jack and Agar does not necessarily should not mean the death of that faceless man, given the context of this chapter. If this happened over like 2 or 3 books, I might not notice, but this all happens in literally like 3 or 4 pages, right?
Right. Huh. Do you think he's how old do you think he is?
The faceless man?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
When she says, I could name your own father, and he says, my sire is long dead.
I didn't actually read into the long dead meaning like cold hands long.
I don't know if we're supposed to read too much into that, but there is a question for me. Because later on, Roose Bolton comes to town and he's talking about the secret of long life.
Yeah.
And so that sort of brings up the topic of like, is this a theme that Martin's developing? But, and then you wonder, okay, well, how long do faceless men live? Do they live the normal amount of life? Or let's say you do don the visage of another person. Are you now sort of running out the mileage on that vehicle?
I would assume they have normal human length lives. They can just change their appearance, but like by changing your appearance into old man, you're uh-huh. not necessarily old. It is like I think there's a bit of like smoke and mirrors involved there, right?
I would imagine so, but I wonder how, like sometimes I wonder, it's like smoke and mirrors, how much is this, of this is smoke and mirrors, and how much of this is an actual magical manifestation? Because, you know, like let's say Arya, who's, let's say, you know, 4'5", let's say she dons the visage of someone who's 6'5", and are people looking up or down, or do they think, are they down but they think they're looking up, or how does this all work? I don't really get it.
Yeah, we don't have enough information, and then we know magic has gotten more prominent since the Rise of Dragons. So are they just better at it now than they were a few years ago?
That's a good point. Do you think that Jack and Hagar is an answer to prayer?
No, I think it is. No, I don't. I don't think there's an association with the old gods of the first men in Westeros and the Weirwoods and the faceless.
Well,
men.
She mentions that if a Grumpkin gives you three wishes,
don't waste them.
You need to be really careful about the third wish.
Mm.
You know, she's almost, there's this little bit like in old Nan's stories, she's learned that the third wish is usually the one that gets you. I don't know if that relates at all to this, but it's interesting.
Yeah, the last time I was on, I did discuss whether Jack and Agar could be a warg.
yeah, wait a second here. I had a guest on, Caitlin Ollie. This is a few months back. And Kate Ollie. And what she says is that if you look carefully, the people who pray in this world, there actually something actually does happen. So it's interesting that she's praying for help. He appears as if out of nowhere. And she even says he was standing as still as one of the trees. So that's interesting that she would confuse him with the tree god or whatever. And then after that, she said, is he an answer? She asked herself that question. Is he an answer to prayer? And this recalls when she first meets Jaqen. She is, and I think that this is a literary metaphor more than anything. It says that she was polishing her hates by reciting her list. And I think polishing her hates parallels, like, you know, Aladdin polishing the lamp. And then the death genie shows up, right?
Okay, yeah, that probably is a literary thing. I didn't spot that.
So there's something about her making the request. Immediately he's there. And then she wonders, is he an answer to prayer? I'm just asking the question. I don't know if I have an answer.
He talks a lot about gods, and he's very explicit about not mocking gods.
He does. He seems to be like a mediator for deities.
And he seems particularly terrified of the red god.
Even he of the fire or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. And then also, like, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but I feel like because Arya saved him and Roshan Biter from the fire, that seems to be why he owes her, not because you took, you know, you snatched lives from any old god. It's because you specifically snatched them from the red god.
Mm-hmm.
He's more spiteful or something like that.
Is there something about the Rise of Dragons where this particular, like the fire magic is getting stronger, and so the red god should be feared a bit more?
It seems to be the case that the red god is getting more important, and the others, we don't observe it as much. Now, I know in the north, I guess we have dire wolves and wargs and stuff, so maybe the old gods are also becoming more prominent, but we have lots of instances of the red god becoming more prominent between Beric Dondarrion, as well as Melisandre's visions and Makoro later on. There's a lot of instances of the red god getting more powerful anyway, so maybe Jaqen H'Kar is just aware of this.
Yeah. One thing that he says that I noted is the gods are not to be mocked. And I noticed that phrase as significant because in the ancient world, the people that you would call atheists were not people that disbelieved in the existence of gods. The people that you would call atheists are people who mock the gods.
Okay.
So we have several people, you know, that word is used, but it's usually of people who like are taunting, like people who are making fun of gods as powerless. That would be someone who would be called an atheist in that world. And so it's almost like here we have Arya in discussion with, I guess, a priestly figure, you know, if you think of him as sort of like a mediator between the gods that are venerated in the House of Black and White. And then here we have Arya, who's, you know, legitimately questioning whether the old gods ever actually helped her father. So for him to use that phrase, it did catch my attention.
Yeah, and then he mentions quite a lot of gods in that list. He starts with something like, he mentions something like the god of air and sea, even he in red, and then mentions many other gods after this. So he does seem to have... he does seem very interested in all of them. But I guess we kind of know that from as well from the Many-Faced God when Arya gets to Braavos. They do sort of...
Mm-hmm.
I guess they've shown an awareness of all gods, right? Or their view, I guess, is all gods are derived from one, this Many-Faced God or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
It is a little bit unclear.
I'm not sure that at this early stage, Martin really has decided the face, what the House of Black and White is going to be and what the faceless men actually are. Because Dany meets this guild of weeping men, assassins in Qarth, and you can hire them. And there's sort of like a sacred guild of assassins who are called like the Sorrowful Men.
Yeah.
And they say that they're sorry when they kill you or whatever. And so it makes me wonder, like, you don't really have this all worked out. Maybe you repurposed that idea for the Faceless Men later on. And maybe at this point in the story, the Faceless Men are connected to R'hllor. But he kind of gardened his way out of that idea.
Yeah, that is possibly true. I put it down to him just being more scared of R'hllor rather than... But yeah, I think you mentioned that in... when you discussed the chapter at the time, that you didn't think he had fully ironed it out.
Yeah, this would be another indication maybe that he doesn't have Faceless Man theology completely worked out at this point.
Yeah, I think that probably is reasonable. There was a good bit of time between that, like, what, nearly 15 years between this book and Dance with Dragons.
Okay, she's given the coin. The coin eventually will be important to her. And at this point, I guess we got to ask. He knows she's a Stark. How does he know that? And does that make her more valuable to him? Like, why recruit a 10-year-old girl to come learn the magical arts of the Faceless Men?
Yeah, I mean, so this is the first chapter he reveals he knows exactly who she is. First, he calls her Arya, and then later on, My Lady of Stark. And then this goes back to again, like, what was his mission in the first place? Like, I mean, is he... A lot of characters sort of revere the Starks a bit for their association with wargs and the old god in winter. So maybe I would believe that his mission could have been just simply to recruit a warg, recruit a Stark, even to recruit Arya. I did question this a lot. Like, how does he know Arya is Arya? But then there are a few hints, like, between the fact that Yaren is hiding her. She disguises herself as a boy. She shouts Winterfell when they're being attacked. There are definitely a few indications, but then we also, like, he's been in the Black Cells. He might really know. Well, he does seem to know a lot of what's going on, though, right? So,
or if he's connected to R'hllor magic, maybe he's seen it in the flame. Yeah. I mean, so even if he knows that she is a Stark, how does he know she's a warg? I mean, that to me, that's the key question. It would make sense. If you're a guild of assassins, a warg could be valuable to you. How does he know to associate this particular 10-year-old girl with this kind of avenue of lost magic?
Yeah, and we did discuss this a bit the last time as well, where I gave two opposing arguments. But one is that he doesn't know she's a warg, right? And the Faceless Men don't know much about wargs. And my head theory is that's how Arya doesn't become a Faceless Man, because she's able to keep some of herself by being a warg, as opposed to being a true Faceless Man, where you have to be truly come no one. Mm-hmm. But then the other argument is he knows she's a warg because he's also a warg, and can identify that somehow.
All right. Do you feel like we've talked enough about Jack and Hagar? Do you have more to talk about?
No, I think we've probably talked Jack and Hagar to the death of Jack and Hagar.
I mean, eventually we'll have to talk about him again if we ever get to the prologue of Dance, right?
To page, yeah. I mean, the only other thing just about him that's very confusing is, like, why did he hang around after Arya effectively rescued them, right? And then why did he hang around until he complete? Was it just to complete this debt to Arya? That's what it seems like. But as you said earlier, more likely is he's trying to recruit Arya, and that goes back to why, and then what's special about her? Why not try and recruit, like, Rickon? Like,
okay, I'm going to the chagrin of many people, I'm going to bring up Deep One's mythology one more time.
Excellent, yeah.
So, interestingly enough, she wonders maybe if Rorge and Biter were called up from hell by Jack and Hagar. Like, maybe he's a devil and maybe he brought with him two demons along the way or whatever. Maybe she's not half wrong. Maybe she's not half wrong here.
I think there's some very nice wordplay as well, because we both think Biter is a squisher, right? And
well, there's no doubt that Biter is a squisher, but I feel like if I get a chance to say Biter is a squisher, I'm always going to take the opportunity to say Biter is a squisher.
There's this nice sort of wordplay here, isn't there? Rorge and Biter could be demons. He called her from some hell, not men at all. And Biter almost certainly is not a man, right? So,
All right, so let's talk about that, because later on, they're trying to free the Northmen from the cells below the King's Spire. I think that. Oh no, the Widow Tower.
Yeah.
And Rorge seems to, you know, he's got a knife and he's cutting people's throat. Biter, he's using his enormous pale hands to break people's necks. So enormous pale hands, and maybe. But then, you know, maybe that's interesting.
Yeah, all the better for swimming with, right?
Yeah, right. But in addition to that, after they're dead, he's like sitting on their chest and gnawing on their fingers?
Mm.
This is not normal behavior.
No, but every time, everything we see of Biter is not normal, right? Like, he also picks up the kettles without any, like Jack and Agar and Arya both have to use gloves and are carrying half each. And then he's just got one on each hand.
And he seems to dislike the heat, but he doesn't seem to, you know, he's not like throwing it down because it was a scalding black cauldron. His big, pale, weird hands are able to absorb the heat in some way.
So and he eats the flesh of a rabbit in the process, or before he picks them up as well. Like, yeah, there's multiple instances of him not having normal human behavior.
Yeah, yeah, and of course, you know, the teeth and the, you know, just the way he's described early on. He does seem to fit the description of what the people of Westeros call squishers. So, anyway.
And somehow, Jack and Agar has some hold over him and Rorge that they will do whatever he asks of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, Jack and Agar is just a man of many tricks, I guess. All right. Is there any? I want to get to Roose Bolton here, but is there anything else about this chapter you want to discuss before we talk about Roose Bolton?
Just very briefly, it wouldn't be having me on this without me discussing magic birds at some point.
Oh, was there? I missed it entirely. Was there a magic bird?
Very early on, when Arya's walking through Harrenhal, and then she's spirits of dead falcons stirred the air with ghostly wings.
Ah, okay. This is all just sort of like to pepper in the mystique of Harrenhal.
Yep.
But notably, they do not talk in this chapter.
No, so. Unfortunately, that's the next chapter where she imagines the crows talking to the dead maester.
Although, I will say this, I thought it was interesting that she's practicing water dancing in the branches.
Mm, yeah.
She's up in the branches, you know, practicing her balance, you know, with a makeshift sword. She's become so good at water dancing. I don't know how long she's in Harrenhal. I don't know how long we're supposed to imagine that she's in Harrenhal, but seemingly she does this pretty often. So she's continued her serial Pharrell training, but now she's using her balance to balance in on tree branches.
Yeah, she seems to be fairly, she should be keeping that up constantly, or consistently maybe.
Okay, you want to talk about Roose Bolton?
Yeah, the main thing I wanted to ask is why does Arya forget how to talk to a lord? So she forgets to say my lord, but then later on, when she's talking to him, she says, yes, your lord, I mean my lord. What's the significance of her getting that wrong?
As the daughter of Ned Stark, does she still have to call the liege lords of Ned my lord? I would imagine yes.
Yeah, I would imagine yes as well.
So the other question is, like, she's never been very good at courtesy all along, right? This is something that Sansa would absolutely know how to say correctly. when Sansa was learning all of that courtesy, Arya was out playing in the mud with Micah or whatever, running through the stables, Arya underfoot, that kind of thing. So that's one idea. Another idea is that maybe she's trying to pretend to be lowborn and stupid so that people underestimate her.
Yeah, that is possible. That or just emotional scarring from the hell she's been through for the last few weeks or months. But yeah, I do think it's like,
it is an odd thing. It is an odd thing to for her not to know that, how to do that correctly. But okay, so here's my question. Does Roose Bolton make her immediately? Does he know immediately that this is Arya Stark?
No. Do you think? I don't think he ever does. Do you think?
I think he does. Yeah. Oh. And here's what I would say. He looks at her, studies her, shows an interest in this little girl, right? And says, "How old are you?" And I think he's at that point realizing, oh, this is these idiots. They had Arya Stark here all along. This is obviously Arya Stark. I can tell by the face of this person that this is a Stark. And this girl is exactly the same age as Arya Stark would be. And then he says, do you like animals? Why does he say that? Why does he say, do you like animals? And she says, I like some. And then he says, but not lions or manticores. This is veiled language. Like, you're a wolf girl. You're clearly not a southern girl, right? I mean, that's how I read it.
Well, I assume the animals thing was because he then asks, how do you feel about leeches, right?
Yeah, of course.
That's where I was going with that. I thought he never figured it out is because in the next chapter, she's sort of privy to some discussion, which I think if he knew he had her, he would be careful about what information he reveals to her, because in the next chapter, he already brings his plan to sort of foil Rob a bit by sending Robert Glover to Duskendale.
You think he'd be more careful?
Yeah.
If he knew for sure that it was Arya.
Yeah. And then there's the gamble of using, Jane Poole as Arya later on, if he knows Arya is still actually out there.
I mean, this is, I wouldn't put it past him for sure, but that is a good point that he seems to be a little bit loose-lipped. You don't imagine Roose Bolton as someone who is who doesn't exercise that kind of caution, right? So maybe so. I mean, that's kind of how I read it, but certainly the text does not give any direct indication that he has made her for a Stark.
Yeah, I assumed he never knew, but I have to reread the next chapter again now and see if there's any more obvious things that would potentially give it away. Because she does talk to him some point in the next chapter, and he's quite annoyed with her for even speaking out of turn. Yeah, right. I kind of thought that would give him more indication of who it might be, but he doesn't seem to show much. Also, he doesn't plan to keep her. You'd think if he knew his Arya, he'd keep her with him, whereas he plans to leave Harrenhal and leave her with Varga Holt.
Right.
She'd be like a very, like, he's already planning betraying Rob, so she's a very valuable hostage.
Or keep her close.
Exactly, yeah. Keep her close and keep up the act. That's what I would imagine he would have done.
Well, you make a good case. Do you think that Roose Bolton is a vampire?
I think there's a surprising amount of similarities between Faceless Men and what Roose Bolton is doing that I hadn't really copped before. I guess that's more something to discuss in the next chapter with the leeches. He just mentioned the long life, and you mentioned that earlier. Like, is that really connected to possibly faceless men living a very long life? But also, the idea, like, flaying and skin changing don't seem that dissimilar. So maybe faceless men do live a long time, and Roose Bolton is trying to carry on that kind of thing. I don't think he's a literal vampire, but I think he's trying to use some kind of blood magic to lengthen his life.
Interesting. So the people who like this theory, and there's a number of iterations of this theory for sure, but the people who like this theory like it because the legacy of Harrenhal is very vampish. And so you've got several characters who seem to have been using blood magic to prolong their life. Why does Roose Bolton want to take Harrenhal? Maybe that's why he's there in the first place, because he's trying to attain some kind of vampirish knowledge.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, in the next chapter, I don't want to go too much in the next chapter, but he is burning a book, which surely he finds in Harrenhal, right? So I imagine he is there for a very specific reason.
He's got the information that he needs, and now he's burning it so no one else can read it.
Yeah.
That's my theory. The other theory about Roose Bolton that I like is that maybe he is the Night King.
Seen that as well. Don't buy it yet.
it's the weird, everyone who meets him notices his weird pale eyes. But I don't know if that's enough. Anyway.
We don't have enough information about the Night King other than they were the 13th Lord Commander in the book, do we? It's a little bit more of a show thing, I suppose.
There's the mythology. There's a particular mythology around that. But of course, Martin likes to have the myths that no one believes anymore.
It's true.
Yeah, find their way to the present in some way.
So. And he also likes to have the option, I think, to leave these open in case he wants to use it later.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Notable introductions. Pink Eye, who's also called Mebel. Ben Blackthumb, we hear about for the first time. Shagwell the Fool and his talking heads, introducing this chapter. And the phrase Velar Morghulis is first uttered in this chapter. Notable show differences. Basically, the three deaths are much different. Although, you do have Arya say the name Jaqen H'ghar to try to gain some leverage over him. But in the show, she tries to use that to escape.
You promised you'd help me.
That was not promised, lovely girl. Only death. There must be others. Give a name, any name.
And you'll kill them. Anybody.
By the seven new gods and the old gods beyond counting, I swear it.
All right. Jaqen H'ghar.
H'ghar gives a man his own name?
That's right.
Gods are not mocked. This is no joking thing.
I'm not joking. Man can go kill himself.
Unname me.
No.
Please?
I'll unname you.
Thank you.
If you help me and my friends escape.
This would require more than one life. This is not part of our bargain.
Fine. Jaqen H'ghar.
A girl lacks honor. If I do this thing, a girl must obey.
A girl will obey.
A girl and her friends will walk through the gate at midnight.
Notable departures. Well, a lot of people die in this chapter. Eventually, let's see here. Do we have any named characters that die in this chapter?
Kind of Emery Lorch. At least he's thrown in with the bear.
So I guess we're gonna say goodbye to Emery Lorch off page. Mm. But yes, he is drug around naked, and then he ends up getting thrown in with the bear, and Arya thinks it's maybe a fitting ending because the bear is black, just like Yoren's clothing is black.
Right. Nice bit of closure for that, for Emery Lorch.
Does Arya waste all her wishes? Is that what we've decided, that Arya wastes every single wish?
I think they're all effectively wasted. Yes, unfortunately. I mean, it was good to get rid of Chiswick. He was awful, but it would have been better to get rid of the mountain.
Yeah, yeah. Or Tywin, or, you know,
or Joffrey.
Yeah, someone of note, but, you know, This made the Harrenhal plot have a bit of intrigue, right?
A lot of intrigue, yeah. And you also have no idea where it's going when you first read it. I think I wouldn't have thought that she wasted all of them on my first read, but now going back and the lack of consequences of those.
Well, and it does show a bit of her development because, you know, she thought, these first two wishes were selfish. I need to do something to help Rob's cause, which she does.
Right? Yeah.
She thinks, I can free 100 Northmen and deliver Harrenhal to the North if I can just get this faceless man to help me do it. And so, you know, she has no idea what's going to happen with Roose Bolton, right? So she's trying to do something for her brother, even though it doesn't really end up helping out.
Indeed.
It's a great chapter. It's packed, action-packed chapter. Thank you for helping me cover it.
It was a pleasure, as always.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne. I'm an adventurous eater, Steve. I will try new things.
Would you try lamprey pie?
I'll tell you what, hot pie is adventurous too, and I'll tell you why.
Oh, go on.
He's suggesting grinding the stone of the cherry.
Right, right.
And sprinkling it on the crust of the pie. And this is actually a debate in the world of culinary science, because cherry pits do indeed have an enzyme that can become cyanide.
Mm-hmm.
So they can be a little bit poisonous. I don't think that they're poisonous enough to do any real damage to you. And I think that you can cook all the poison out.
Okay.
But I've gone to a few blogs, and I've gone to bonappetit.com. And it seems to me that hot pie is in the right. You can cook with the pits of cherries.
See, hot pie is just sort of considered throwaway. And he's like, oh, he's just got this big appetite. He's a little bit of a gourmand.
He really is. He's a genius that will not be appreciated in his time.
No. Which is that's what kind of got me. I'm looking at the unsavory tone of this entire area and the awful things they said to Arya, and just in general, it's just mucky. Yet hot pie just seems like what makes hot pie so charming that he could just get is he just keeping these ne'er-do-wells just flush with pie, and they're just like, look, I mean, he hasn't worked like an hour. Man, he does this thing with the cherry stones. I don't even care if it'd kill me. It's delightful.